start that. I didn't need correcting.
Shut up! Order!
Order! Let's start off as we need to go on.
We can see a better future.
So it's not a competition who can shout the loudest.
Hello, you're listening to the Life Flingers podcast. I'm Ross.
I'm Brandon.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm George.
Oh my gosh, who's this?
Ooh.
George, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I would. Hello, I'm George Fairhurst. You might know me as the host of Irrelevant Podcast, Red Rose Supporting. You might also know me as chair of the Yorkshire and Humber Young Fabians and also as the assistant organiser for CIRA. Basically, if it's environmental or based on history, I'm your man. I also make lots of unfunny jokes on my Twitter, so that's probably how most people know me.
You really do a good job of kind of underselling yourself, George. You always do this when you come on the podcast, because you are almost a regular on the podcast, and you always say, oh, I've got nothing going on, and a podcast is irrelevant, and all that kind of stuff. But you are a big deal. Everybody knows you. Everybody knows what you do.
This is the thing, though, but I don't want to come on across as some sort of Billy Big Head, because then I'm setting your audience's expectations so low, so therefore they're bound to be impressed by what I do. It's like, wow, this is actually kind of Cofferton. Wow, I didn't expect this from this guy. It's all marketing, Brandon. It's all marketing.
I think it was Ed Balls said that that's what Gordon Brown done when Labour came into power, is we set the expectations quite lower. We said we were only going to, like, maybe put the minimum wage to £4, but we done it to £5, and then everyone was like, wow, Jesus.
You know? Yeah, exactly. So when people come to listen to Red Rose Reporting and they find out that we actually cover a lot of good topics and we have some actually semi-good content, they're going to be like, oh, I didn't expect this. Might just stick around. So there's methods of the madness. Don't worry.
Under-promise and over-deliver, sounds like.
Mm-hmm. That's the plan.
Challenge accepted. Can George over-deliver on this podcast? We'll find out, listeners.
We're going to find out. Yeah, we've got some interesting stuff to talk about this podcast. But yes, that is who I am. And if you like the sounds of what I talk about in this podcast, you can find me on Twitter at Fabian Fairhurst. So.
Amazing. Well, thank you for coming on. We really appreciate it. If anyone else just happens to be listening and fancies coming on the Left Wing, just let us know. We do a lot of these news reviews quite often, and we do a lot of wins with us, and we'd love to have you on. So without further ado, let's kick off into this week's news. I think the first thing we have to talk about, obviously, is the rise in COVID cases. So I think I read a statistic that was last week, one in 60 people in the UK had COVID. And I was quite alarmed to read that. And the government set out a plan A and a plan B. So what might happen if winter doesn't turn out as well as we thought it would? I'm so worried about what happened last year basically happening again, where the government says everything's fine, everything's fine, everything's fine. And then with 2 days to go until Christmas, actually, no, you can't do anything and you've got to stay exactly where you are. But I'd be curious to see what happens there. But I have to say, especially in London, there's not a lot of, I was traveling this week in London, not a lot of people wearing masks and not a lot of people social distancing.
Well, actually, I've been quite impressed by just my local area and people still wearing masks. I would say about over half of people are probably still wearing masks as they use public transport, as they're going to shops. And, you know, that's quite cool to see that people are just doing this off their own backs and they care about kind of keeping the virus under control. One thing that I will say, and it's an ongoing critique that I have of the government, is the lack of caution in their wording. They seem to be thinking kind of short-term messaging and getting people feeling positive about what the government's doing, rather than kind of issuing caution and saying, actually, we are the government, we are meant to be responsible, and our first priority is actually controlling the virus, rather than kind of pushing ahead with a lack of restrictions because that's politically convenient.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely curious to see what happens in the next couple of months, but I have a feeling that they won't take any action and then it will be too late and then we'll have more restrictions at Christmas. But I question, if we have restrictions at Christmas, who actually will obey them? I think the public are a little bit tired now of hearing about all these things we can and can't do. And I question whether people are just going to take their safety into their own hands or whether you know, I think you've got to keep an eye on the death numbers. You've got to keep an eye on the hospitalization numbers. And then I think another thing that we haven't spoken about is you've got to keep an eye on the booster jab numbers. You know, I don't know that many people that have been called up for their booster jabs, but I mean, I'm due to have mine, I think, next summer, because it's supposed to be 180 days after your second. But I don't know that many people that are over 70s or over 60s who've been asked to go and get their booster jab. And I think the best thing we can do before Christmas is get as many people booster vaccinated as possible.
So what would you like to see happening in England? Do you think it's time to bring back, you know, mandatory mask wearing? Do you think social distancing's too much of a stretch? What are you thinking? I mean, I know you aren't experts, but obviously we are still living with some form of restrictions in Scotland. What would you like to see come into place?
So what do you have in Scotland at the minute?
So at the moment we have mask wearing still mandatory. And events over, I think it's 5,000, you've got to provide proof of vaccination. The only place indoor which is exempt from masks are nightclubs, but you do have to wear them going in and out of the premises. So it's small measures. How much of an effect it's had on cases, I don't know.
I mean, I think we've got quite similar down here, no? Doesn't seem too far away. Because when we went into conference last month, everyone had to show their COVID vaccination pass.
I think that was because of the organisers, though. I don't think that was necessarily because of government restrictions.
Yeah, that was the party that decided to do that, but that's not law. That's not true. I've said about 5,000. It is for nightclubs. You will also need vaccine passports, which are very complicated to get, by the way. Like, it's really not an easy system that they've brought out.
Do you not have an app for it?
No, we have nothing. We have to go into.
I assumed like England, you'd have the app for it that you can just download off.
The way I'm working it at the moment is I've sent myself like a link to mine's on WhatsApp, and I just go through my WhatsApp and show them it that way. But to be honest, no one's really checking it.
That's a very complex way of getting a vaccine passport. That's madness.
Yeah, I think it was because it was quite a last minute decision. Like at first we said we weren't going to do them when the rest of the UK was doing them. And then we, at the last minute, changed our mind. And now we have passports, but not really a system for anybody to use them. Because there is QR codes on them, but no one has the scanners. Very odd.
Well, you know, I was actually reading about what's going on with the COVID case rises and why Scotland seems to have had a bit of a worse pandemic than other parts of the UK. And what both of them seem to show is that since COVID cases are rising in England as fast as they are in Scotland, what both places are doing at the same time is they're allowing mass indoor mixing. And I think that might be off the menu come November time or perhaps further into the winter. I could see them just, you know, putting like a restriction of, you know, 6 max meet up in a household or something at the worst case scenario. Although I would just also say one thing, which I don't think I've seen any chatter about returning, and I'm so grateful for this, is the tier system, because that was dreadful. Did you have the tier system in Scotland? Was that a thing?
Yeah, we did, but there wasn't as much of a sort of tolerance like there is down south. Like most of Scotland was in the same tier for a very long time, with the exception of Glasgow, which was like in tier 3 for, I think it was like a year or something. Like we were the only place that didn't get out of lockdown. And, you know, once COP's over, we'll probably be back in it, because there's going to be 30,000 folk arriving in Glasgow for 3 weeks. So we'll see what happens over the next month or so.
Yeah, we will. You've mentioned COP26, and that's kind of what I'm... Well, when they asked me to come on the podcast, Brandon and co, they were like, do you want to talk about anything? And there's only one thing I can talk about in my line of work, which is COP and the environment, because in a couple of weeks' time, half the world's leaders will be descending on Glasgow to try and see if they can find a solution to the climate crisis. And in the lead up to that, the government on Tuesday dumped about 400 pages of documents out trying to lay out a net zero strategy and also the long-awaited heating and buildings strategy. The long and short of it is we're going to try and get UK homeowners to have heating pumps rather than gas boilers, although only 90,000 people will be able to get the scheme by 2024. And the actual net zero strategy in place is a jumble of different policies, which in the long and short of it will make us more reliant on nuclear power. We'll see an expansion of renewables and will eventually see us determine what we're going to do with hydrogen, although that's been kicked into the long grass for 2026. The verdict from most people who I know within like environmental circles is that this doesn't go far enough, and it's not bold enough, it's not fast enough, and it seems to be the case that the government has realised they've got to do something now to get the climate crisis under control, and they've thrown a lot of stuff at the wall, and they're going to see what sticks. What will stick, I'm not too sure, but that is kind of where we're at with COP26 and also net zero as a whole right now. So unfortunately, we seem to have gone from one depressing subject, the rise of COVID cases, to an even more depressing one of how the planet might be absolutely screwed, because COP26 is probably not going to be the thing that delivers a strategy towards keeping the climate safe. It's being described inside government as a damp squib by Alok Sharma, the president of COP26, who's raging about the fact that Boris Johnson's not giving funds because Rishi Sunak is refusing to spend much on saving the planet because he wants to save money and cut taxes for bankers.
Yeah, I mean, I think you covered quite a lot there, George. If listeners want to know a little bit more about COP26, they can go back to our episode with Olivia Blake, MP, where she goes through a little bit of insight into what COP26 would mean, especially for the Labour movement. So, George, one of the things you mentioned there was nuclear power. And I think you skirted over it quite quickly, because it's quite controversial within the Labour movement to talk about nuclear power. So I know, obviously, you're the assistant organiser for CERA, so I realise that you might have to have a personal and a professional opinion, which are different. But what do you not think that nuclear power is the only realistic solution to solving climate change in the next 10 to 15 years?
I don't think it is. I think the issue of nuclear power, and this stems from my own beliefs, because I just don't trust the entire like industry around it. I mean, I'm quite biased because I found things like Chernobyl on Sky a few years ago quite informative on the subject. And I've always kind of thought they're inherently...
What, the drama?
Yeah, the drama. Because
right, okay.
Quite
sorry, I just there. Wasn't sure if you were talking about the drama or like another documentary that you'd watched.
Yes, I watched drama and that kind of opened my eyes to the dangers of nuclear power. And then since then, looking at stuff like the catastrophe at Fukushima in Japan and kind of the inherent dangers of nuclear power in itself, I just don't see it as a viable alternative because the risks are just too high, because we could save the planet from climate crisis only for the whole thing to just become an irradiated disaster zone for humanity. And when you screw up with nuclear, you screw up for like centuries and centuries where things won't be able to come back and live. It is really a dangerous scenario, and I don't trust a government which, frankly, even in the safe stuff like renewables, they've dramatically underfunded. Like this heating and building strategy, there was meant to be £9.2 billion for home improvement of like energy efficiency across the UK spent by 2024. This entire strategy, which will go, I think, to about 2028, is going to spend about £3.9 billion. The Conservatives, when they're in power, they like to cut costs at every single step. I don't trust them, frankly, with nuclear power, because I think they would think they could save money somewhere and they would royally screw up. And that's not a mess where someone has to come out and apologise with a red face. That's a mess where part of the country becomes untenable for humans to live in. I just don't see it as a safe strategy, and I'm really against us bringing this out. I know that we're getting closer towards climate disaster, and drastic times call for drastic measures, but still, I think you've got to draw a line somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting. I don't necessarily think it's... While I think you can acknowledge that the Conservative government is incompetent, I don't think it's fair to say that, like, Boris Johnson himself will be organising, like, the nuclear strategy. I think they'd probably, you know, kind of maybe, like, the Civil Aviation Authority or, like, the BBC or, like, things like that, which are kind of linked to the government but aren't technically part of the government. I think that we already have nuclear weapons, and they're equally as... I think if you already have nuclear weapons, it's all dangerous all the time anyway. So you might as well just... I don't think renewables are necessarily the one-shop solution to the mass problems that climate change brings. And I don't think it's foreseeable to have our current energy system as it is to switch to renewables in the next 3 to 5 years. I can't really see it happening.
It needs kind of radicalism, which unfortunately we don't
and
have.
Under a Labour government, I think it would be government. Possible. Under a Labour government that was very, very climate focused, I would believe that would be doable, but I just don't see it being a key part of the Conservative strategy.
No, I can't either, which is just kind of why whenever this discussion comes up, kind of have my head in my hands. It's like how I mentioned, they've decided that they're going to discover what hydrogen power can do by 2026, but not incorporate it in, you know, any kind of road to net zero plan properly. It's just weird that we've got these emerging technologies which can work, which are safer than nuclear, but our response to that is, we'll come to that eventually. We'll think about it. And until then, we get closer and closer towards the planet becoming unlivable for future generations. It's just baffling, you know?
So, George, will you be attending COP as a representative for CERA? And if not yourself, I imagine you'll have some sort of representation there. What do you hope to achieve?
Quite a lot of CERA's executive are actually going to be going to COP. I myself will not be going because of the fact that we're not doing like an official CERA stall within the main halls and such like that. And even if we were, from the sounds of the amount of industrial action going off in Glasgow, I don't think I could actually physically get into the city. So it would be quite impossible. But the global rapporteur for parliamentarians, Alex Sobel, who's on the CERA executive, will be there, who is actually behind probably the main Labour event for COP, which is called Our Last Best Chance, Global Left Perspectives on COP26. It's going to be on Saturday the 6th of November at 6 p.m, followed by a social event. So, you know, like all good events at a conference, it's a serious talk followed by drinks afterwards. Perfect. You're going to have names there such as Eva Murray, who's going to be chairing the event. As I say, Alex Sobel's going to be there. We've got Senator Jacques Wagner, who I believe is he the governor of California right now?
I don't know who the current governor of California is, Gavin but Newsom. I wish it was Arnold.
Gavin Newsom's the governor of California.
And I quite like the idea in my head. I have a picture of like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Alex Sobel like standing next to each other. And that makes me laugh just for like so many reasons.
I think the universe would collapse if those two met. There's just certain people who I can't imagine being in the same room at the same time. I think just pure
magic. It's like a little and large Sobel duo. And it's quite cute,
that's
isn't
pretty
it?
Big. It's like, oh. That's pretty significant.
What's this?
Alex Sobel and the Pope. That's quite a moment.
Yeah, very jealous. I just want to say, I was very jealous that he was able to do that. very jealous. It's a little bit unfair. Not going to lie. Some of us have been dedicated Catholics for years and haven't met the Pope. Other people just walk in whenever they want. Unbelievable.
Oh, the audacity. Speaking of global people, it's also COP for another reason I believe is going to be a bit of a damp squib is because the president of China, Xi, is not going to be there. He's just simply not going to attend, and neither is Vladimir Putin, who are kind of two of the big people we need to get on board for any kind of net zero strategy across the world to keep 1.5 alive.
Are the Chinese not sending anyone?
Nope.
They've not sent anybody?
I've not seen that they're sending people. So they're just not going to be there. It's only by a sheer miracle we've got Modi, the president of India, coming.
But doesn't China lead the way in renewable technology?
They do, but they're also...
renewable energy.
They also... See, China's quite complex because at the minute they're actually increasing the amount of coal-fired power stations that they use because of the fact there's an energy crisis going off in China. Whilst at the same time they've ended overseas funding of coal plants, it's madness. I could ramble all day about China's Belt and Road program and how that's terrifying and how climate action internationally is actually really good for like foreign relations and stuff. And it's why there is kind of a bit of a proto-Cold War going off right now between different people funding. And you can see that even going off in Afghanistan of all places. But I as Brandon mentioned before we start recording, we don't have all that much time for each section. So I don't want to keep this podcast going for 2 hours.
Are the Taliban coming?
I don't.
No, but I'm serious. Like, no, I'm just like, I'm genuinely serious. Like, I'm actually curious as to because I actually find this to be really interesting. So, the
main people going probably are G20 nations. They're not going. Small nations who are actually already affected by climate change, which is quite terrible. I mean, I don't think Bangladesh are sending representatives, despite the fact that they are on the front lines right now of just being, seeing what the climate crisis is going to do in a few generations to Europe and the West.
I always find it interesting because obviously the Taliban is a hostile regime, but they are, my understanding is that they currently are the official government of Afghanistan. So that's why I was curious to see.
You know, it wouldn't actually shock me that much if they were, because the US has agreed to give like foreign aid donations now to Afghanistan under a Taliban government. So, the fact that the big dogs are not going, kind of, you can see in contrast, I'm going to mention Gordon Brown here because he kind of was the best at this. Most prime ministers, whenever they hold like a big world summit or when there's something big needs doing, like a COP summit, they tend to go around the last few months before it happens, meeting world leaders, twisting arms, being like, look, you've got to come, you've got to be there. and basically almost being like little West Wing, you know, TV movie characters or something like that, going around, congealing, meeting, and making sure that it all comes together. Boris Johnson, in contrast, has gone on holiday a few times and hasn't really talked to that many people and has been frosted out by Joe Biden, who, as I understand, is also holding out on making sure that the pledged funding of $100 billion a year for climate action across the third and developing world is just not going to happen. That's something that should have been delivered by 2020, and it wasn't. And everyone said, oh, we'll try to get it done by 2024, and now that looks like it's not happening. So there's a lot of disappointment on the climate front, unfortunately. I wish I had some positive message that I could bring you, but alas, not.
So it doesn't seem that the conference itself is going to be too cheery from what you've described, but let's hope that you're wrong. But
I don't think that's, I think that's a little unfair to say that it's all very, very negative. I don't think that's fair by any stretch of the imagination, actually. I think it's fair to say that it's very challenging to get world leaders into a room, and that requires some really smart ambassadors and delegation who do all their work behind closed doors and do it undercover, and you never know that they exist. And the deal is always written, it's pretty much written before everyone gets into the room, and then when they get into the room, they sign it.
Hmm.
But I watched the what's called the Earth Shot Prize. I watched that a couple of nights ago, and I actually looked at all the technologies that people are building to combat climate change or to slow down the process of climate destruction. And I thought, actually, yeah, okay, maybe the politicians can't get into a room and figure it out, but I think if there was a little bit more political will, they'd be able to. I think there's just a lot of people put their nation's interests above the climate emergency, which I guess I understand that, because people don't vote for candidates on the whole that put, you know, the nation's, like, the world's well-being above their nation. But if you look at the Earthshot Prize, you look at some really fantastic entrepreneurs, innovators, young people we're talking about on this podcast now, I'd say in comparison to maybe 20 years ago, I think that the majority of people in the UK acknowledge that there is a climate emergency, or that climate change is having a bad impact or having an adverse impact. Things change, that will keep growing. So I think it's very easy to be pessimistic, because there isn't, you know, a white piece of paper coming out of a big conference where it's like, well, we've signed this big deal. But to be honest, most of the deals that have been signed in the past 20, 30 years ago were signed, and then everyone left the room and conveniently forgot. So I don't, you know, yeah. I have very mixed opinions about it. Of course, I hope that something is done, but...
What you described there, Kathleen, actually quite succinctly, is what a lot of people right now across the world are doing, which is laying out different definitions of what a good COP conference would look like. And the issue that this one has got in particular is that Boris Johnson has no concept of expectation management. I think the final quote I'll give you before we move on is that he described himself as the Moses of climate change. But that analogy only really worked if Moses was just known for leading a bunch of people into the desert to walk around for 40 years, not quite finding the way back to the promised land. You know, if I come on again in a few months' time after the COP, we'll see how it goes. And I must admit, I commend your optimism. And you are, of course, completely correct. There's a lot of emerging technology within the UK and abroad of electrical vehicles. Right now, they're developing massively. Electrical buses, transport infrastructure, it's all coming out. It's just not being done at a fast enough rate without the proper funding, which is why I am unfortunately a colossal pessimist. But I believe I've whinged on long enough on this subject.
Well, hang on. You said the Moses. Right, you said the Moses thing, but who's God in that? If Boris is Moses...
That's a whole different discussion.
Who's, like, I don't understand that analogy. That's so strange. Like, is Dominic Cummings God?
I mean, he wrote that in his weird Sun article where the main picture was him, like, highlighted in green, which was baffling. And he had loads of different weird phrases because, of course, Boris Johnson, he had a street sign statement. I think the God in this thing would probably be, like, Al Gore or someone like that, you know?
How you doing? Chris Mitchell for the GMB Trade Union. I'm proudly standing here right outside the Strike office where the battle plans have been made. 1 week to go. Cleansing workers will make history. When they demand a better pay rise from Kozola!
So it seems that my hometown hero, Chris Mitchell from the GMB Trade Union, has taken over Twitter, has taken over the world. Kathleen, you've mentioned that you've not seen this. I don't know how. Basically, I'll explain the situation as to what's going on in Glasgow over the next few weeks. First of all, we had the bin men, or the refuge workers, led by Chris Mitchell, who is the convener, GMB union official. He basically posts a video at 5 o'clock every morning. He goes around all the different depots, sort of rallying the troops. And the videos are just like, it's like three espressos just chucked down your throat and you're like, wow. Like, we love Chris. But there's a wider issue in Glasgow in that we're hosting this massive conference for 30,000 people and the city's just going to be a dump because, you know, they're going on strike and rightly so. They've not been given a fair pay rise in years. And, you know, they've held out. And they've decided that this enough's enough. This is the time to do it. We've also got the train workers going on strike. We've got no trains. Buses, as of the other day, are now going on strike also. So we're hosting this big friendly climate summit with no public transport. You know, the streets are just going to be manky. And we had Kate Forbes, the finance secretary of the Scottish Government, come out and say, oh, well, we're painting the streets and we're giving them a lick of paint. So what they're basically saying is they're, you know, dressing it all up for everyone to come and arrive in a city. But it's fine if the people of Glasgow have been allowed to live like this for the last 5 years, 10 years, because Glasgow, I don't know when the last time he's visited. It's just a dump right now. Like, there's rats literally running around the city centre, biting people on an almost daily basis. The city is a wreck, and, you know, we're supposed to be hosting this big climate summit. Brandon, I can see you chuckling away.
Sorry, it is a very serious topic. I just love the way that you describe some things.
I hear about the rats, guys. I can't believe that.
The rat pit shocked me. Like, it did.
That's horrible.
Have you seen Chris's rat? Have you seen the big, huge rat that he walks around with?
No, I haven't, actually.
Oh, it has a name and I can't remember what it is. They have a it's maybe like an 8-foot rat that they take around with them when they're shooting the videos sometimes. I'll show you.
And Nef Winders at home, remember, if you ever need to run a campaign, an 8-foot rat would always help.
we'll post a picture of the rat on our Twitter page for you to appreciate. And we're going to see it now if Ross can find it. What I like about Chris as a character is that he's bringing a lot of passion and getting people excited about trade unions, trade unionism and worker collective action, which, you know, a lot of people kind of look at the trade union movement as if it's something that's like was only relevant in the past. Well, actually, what the kind of actions of, oh my gosh, that is a big rat. That is a massive rat. Sorry, I can just see the rat on my screen. Thank you for that.
Do you know what? I was going to say the rat is actually going to be joined by a polar bear when COP26 actually gets going, because there is a polar bear travelling to this gigantic 10-foot polar bear is being lugged across Cumbria to get to Glasgow in time for the conference.
Oh no.
The name of this podcast now should be The Rat and the Polar Bear.
That is what it's going to be called.
Thank you for that, George. Yes, so what I like about him is that he's getting people enthused about trade unionism and actually showing that it's very relevant today. In fact, I would argue it's more relevant now than it has been for the past 20, 30 years. And I like that people are sharing this video because it's actually showing what trade unions are doing on a day-to-day basis. You know, they're rallying together workers, getting them to stand up for their rights, and through collective action, hopefully, the refuse workers in Glasgow will actually earn a pay rise and get the outcomes that they want. But I love that kind of enthusiastic activism, because it's not something that we have enough of in this country, I don't think.
I've just found out that the rat's name's Cludgy, which is a Glaswegian word for toilet. So they have a rat called Toilet.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we Glaswegians know how to strike.
Yeah, you do. I think this
so just quickly, why did this guy Chris become famous?
Right, you'll need to watch the videos. There's a context to this. He does these videos with all the workers like every morning, and Chris is the most high energy man.
Is he a hype? Is he the hype man?
He is the hype man.
Right. Okay.
And he's become like Twitter famous in the last like 48 hours. I mean, we've all known about him for years because he has been doing these videos for years. But it seems that he's just taken over the world in the last few days.
There was this amazing one I watched where he not only does these hype videos in front of the camera with all these people in the background, he can also do like the walk and talk monologue ones, because I watched this one where it was like there was a bin strike from last year where he was just walking down this fleet of like striking workers and stuff, and he's got so much charisma. I absolutely love it. And it goes into this larger thing of ever since the pandemic, one of the few, dare I say, benefits of COVID is that everyone's kind of realised the worth of their labour. So people are actually demanding better wages and they're realising they want to have more work with dignity, and I'm absolutely loving it.
Like you say, it is one of the very few positives, like refuge workers, care workers, nurses, like these people who do not earn like a massive salary have all of a sudden became like sought after and highly valued in society, and it's about time they got the pay rise they deserved. Have you seen the Liam Neeson, like one of Chris?
Yes, I have seen that one.
Yes.
You put it in the chat, I think, yesterday.
It's beautiful. Again, we'll stick this somewhere on our Twitter page because it's worth a watch. It is very funny. But obviously the serious message behind it as well. It's a great thing what he's doing, and it's just great to see. So another thing that I'd like to kind of bring to the attention of Kathleen Ross, George, and you at home listening is the kind of, for me, the rise of fake news on websites that are traditionally more geared towards young people and arguably left-wing politics. So I'm talking kind of Instagram mainly. That's the most obvious example, but also to an extent kind of Twitter and Snapchat. And I am particularly worried about the rise of people sharing posts with the best intention, don't get me wrong, but are dangerous because they're spreading misinformation and in some cases getting people more scared about the news than is necessary. And the incident which I point to the most is the most obvious example recently, and why I've actually wanted to discuss this today, was following the reports of women in particular getting spiked in nightclubs over the past couple of weeks and kind of the dangers around that suddenly becoming a lot more prevalent than they were before. There's been stories circulating about people being diagnosed with HIV shortly after actually being spiked. And that has led the National AIDS Trust to actually put out a statement saying that it's not possible for somebody to be diagnosed with HIV so shortly after being injected with a needle, and that's actually quite an unlikely transmission anyway. And I just think, you know, those kind of fake stories that were circulating around have got people so justifiably worried about this increase in spiking incidents, not just for the fact that there is spiking and that is a worry in itself and something that we need to take action on, but also getting them worried about something that isn't actually a risk of spiking. And I feel like that those kind of fake news stories circulating on these websites are really harmful. And I just wish that people would take a bit of time and ask who's putting this story on and where it's coming from. Give it a Google, have a look. Have a see where these stories are originating from, because through a quick Google, most of the time you can see whether or not a story's false or not. Have any of you experienced this kind of circulation of fake news?
Yeah, I did see it floating around the other day on Instagram. It was people posting it on their Instagram stories about this girl who had been spiked, you know, with a needle, and then it was basically like, I think it was 24 hours later, had been, you know, diagnosed with HIV, which just isn't possible, as my understanding is. It takes about 2 weeks for the antibodies to actually show up in any test. Instagram does, I've noticed, do a good job. See, when you post things about COVID on your Instagram story or anything like that, it will immediately like flag it, and it will put up like a sort of link to a sort of information page to do with COVID. So it'd be quite handy if they could do that with, you know, other things, whether it be HIV, I don't know, maybe cancer, anything that could be in any way sort of harmful to someone's health. That's a small step we could take. And it's just, you know, be careful what you're sharing. If you don't know the backgrounds of things, have a wee look into it before you share something which could possibly, you know, rile someone up.
Well, I think the think before you post is a good idea on any platform for anything anyway. I mean, I think it's so easy for people just to be scared about something and then just to repost it. I think our governments and society has to come together and answer the question, whose job is it to regulate fake news or to make sure that things are as truthful as they can be on social media platforms? And I think that the governments don't think it's their responsibility, and the social media companies don't think it's their responsibility. And is it possible for a platform with a couple of thousand employees to influence and to provide a system of establishing what is fake news and then taking it off the platform? Is that possible to do for potentially billions of users who upload every day? Mm-hmm. And do they think that that's their job? I don't know, but then if I was to go outside and write on a wall, you know, obviously I wouldn't, but like if I was to graffiti on a wall something that's fake news, it's not the owner of the building's job to moderate whatever rubbish I'd written. Like, obviously they'd take it down in their own time, but I don't think it's, I don't know. I just have, like, if people put out fake news or they share things, whose job it is, I don't know whose job it is to regulate that.
A big debate that's kind of raging in America, because they're talking about regulating social media companies, and there's kind of two sides to the argument. There's the Democrats saying, well, social media companies have been a platform for sharing fake news, and then there's the Republican side of, oh, social media companies are shutting down our ability to have free speech because of, for example, them taking Donald Trump's social media pages down. And I think the problem that we have in terms of potential government regulation of fake news is that there's not enough expertise in government on the issue. You know, social media as a concept is fairly new, and there's not a lot of, and I think the people who are most used to using social media, young people, they're obviously, most of them, not of the age to be high up in government policy decision making. And that's reflected in how the government responds to not just regulating social media, but regulating the internet. I feel like there's a big kind of knowledge gap in government policy that may take some time to be filled by new talents coming up. And I don't know necessarily what the government can do about this, but on an individual level, you know, just kind of be wary of what you're posting, because we all do have an individual responsibility to make sure that what we're sharing and what we're posting is legitimate information.
I mean, I completely agree with that, and think before you post, but it's completely, but if the, for example, the UK government, which I don't think they will, but if they did, said to the main social medias, said to the leaders, it is your responsibility to regulate fake news, and we are placing that blame on you, and there is a series of fines or structures or problems that we'll have, or a process that we can go through, and that's fine. And say, you know, there was somehow they managed to enforce a law that said you cannot post something that's classified as fake news in the UK ever again. It will be taken down immediately. We'll have systems in place. Okay, but what about the other 120 countries that have access to the internet and they're able to post fake news? So if you don't read it from the UK, you'll read it from the US. And if it's from a you think it's from a legitimate source or somebody you trust, I don't think it's just one government. But then I also don't think that there's anybody that is brave enough or capable of standing up to these social medias, most of which are actually owned by like one or two people. Remember, Facebook owns WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook.
I think to expand on Kathleen's point of the issue of how do you regulate it when, you know, it's posted worldwide, another big issue, which as Brandon points out, people in government perhaps won't be able to comprehend because they're not of an age to understand social media properly, is the advent of VPNs. So there is nothing to stop somebody in the UK from having a VPN saying they're from China or whatever, and then posting fake news and malicious content from there and it being fine. I think that the deep misunderstanding of social media is going to basically hold back this entire development of, you know, the advent of fake news, because the recent thing where there's been like these Instagram things sharing of stories is kind of, in my view, the complete circle of the development of fake news media, because each platform has got its own version of fake news which works most efficiently. So like on Facebook, you share, you know, some article from a news site you've never heard of claiming that, like, you know, the Clintons were in deep with something. On Twitter, you can just spout nonsense and, you know, claim you have a source, and that's it. It gets shared around widely. With Instagram now, with these like official looking slides and infographics and stuff being shared around, that's the complete circle in my view. So I don't really have an answer of how this is solved beyond individual responsibility of not even just checking what you're posting is accurate and stuff, like, because that in itself sounds like a really big job for an individual, but it's not. It's like on most social media sites, if you want to see if it's true, just go in the comment sections, like look for the top six comments, because if it's fake news, there is more likely someone who has done you already the favor of posting, this is fake, why have you said this? And they'll be fighting a massive war in the comments. You can see that there's disputes over, you know, whether this is accurate or not. If you're still going to post that, then in my opinion, sorry to be blunt, you're a bit of a dick, but, you know, most people will say, oh, this isn't really true, I probably shouldn't share this. Because, you know, most people and they're online are not out there trying to willingly spread this stuff, because as everyone's pointed out, they're sharing this because they're worried and they're a bit scared, and fearful people do stuff which is sometimes just a bit stupid. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week, as we are now wrapping up this episode. If you've enjoyed my ramblings and you want to follow me further, check out my podcast, which you can find on Twitter at Red Reporting. We do a bi-weekly show where we look at all the various political polls going off, and we have started up again our series looking at the history of Red Wall seats, analysing their history between 1931 to 2019, looking at all the key characters and social developments. Brandon's going to be on his own episode very soon, looking at the history of Barnsley Central, which you're not going to want to miss. There is a lot of controversy there. Thank you very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed my time in the Left Wingers, and it's always a pleasure to come on this podcast.
No, thank you for coming on to talk to us. It's always great to have you on, and I'm sure you'll be on again shortly in the future anyway.
maybe. So thank you for listening to this edition of Whinge With Us, and please do check out the social medias, which one of the other three is just going to quickly reel off.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do, as George said, on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. And also don't forget to tell your friends about us. That's the main way we grow our podcast. Keep whinging, and we'll see you soon.